Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining our virtual community and supporting our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the support button at BethEmmanuel.org.
I hesitate to tell you this joke because for two reasons. Number one, you may have already heard it. I think some of you haven't. But number two, it might reinforce some unfair stereotypes. But I'm going to tell you it anyway, because it really illustrates the point I like to make pretty well. So there are three Hasidim who were once talking with each other and bragging about their respected rebbes. Of course, in Hasidus, not only do they have rabbis in the traditional, conventional sense, but each community has its rebbe, the grand spiritual leader, who's considered very righteous, very holy, admired by all. And some of them have been even known to pray and receive miracles when dire situations arise. So the first chassid told his story. He said, the Rebbe and his chassidim were walking to the Beis Midrash when a great snowstorm arose. And it was so cold, and there was fierce wind, and the snow was making it impossible for us to find our way. And we cried out to the Rebbe, Rebbe, we can't make it through the snow. Please help us, Rebbe. What do we do? And instantly, the Rebbe closed his eyes tightly, and he entered a state of dvekus. It's like cleaving, like a clinging to God. And his lips whispered a prayer. And then suddenly, in front of us, there was snow. And behind us, there was snow. And to the left and to the right, there was snow. Right around the Rebbe, there was no snow, and we were able to arrive at the Beis Midrash unharmed. The second chassid told his story. My Rebbe has done even greater than this. The Rebbe and his chassidim were walking to the Beis Midrash when it began to rain, and it was a downpour, and there was thunder, and there was lightning, and we thought we would be swept away by a flash flood. And we yelled to the Rebbe, help us, Rebbe! What do we do? And the Rebbe closed his eyes, and he entered a state of dvekus, and his mouth moved as he uttered a soft prayer. And suddenly, in front of us and behind us, there was rain. And to the left and to the right of us, there was rain. But all around the Rebbe, there was no rain. And the third chassid told a story. He said, that's nothing. You should hear what my Rebbe is able to do. One Shabbos, the Rebbe and his chassidim were walking to the Beis Midrash when they spotted a gold coin in the road. And we cried out to the Rebbe, with that one gold coin, we could do so much tzedakah. We could buy a new Sefer Torah. And at that moment, the Rebbe closed his eyes and entered a state of dvekus, whispering a short prayer. Then suddenly, in front of us and behind us, there was Shabbos. To the left and to the right, there was Shabbos. But all around the Rebbe, there was no Shabbos. Now, of course, the reason why this joke is funny is because of its absurdity. You know, because Shabbos is not something that you can just repel like mosquitoes. You can ignore it. You can pretend it doesn't exist, or you could go through your life without even knowing that it exists, or you can think it's some other day. But Shabbos is Shabbos, whether you accept it or not. And so these fictional Hasidim are being ridiculous because they think their Rebbe is somehow able to ward off Shabbos when in reality he has done absolutely nothing. So it's not hard, of course, to draw some similarities between these fictional Hasidim and some followers of Yeshua. In fact, it's reminiscent of these passages from Romans 14, right? Romans 14, 2-3, one person believes he may eat anything, while the weak person eats only vegetables. Let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains, and let not the one who abstains pass judgment on the one who eats, for God has welcomed them. Verses 5 and 6, one person esteems one day is better than another, while another person esteems all days alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. The one who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord. And then look at this verse, verse 14. I know and am persuaded in the Lord Jesus that nothing is unclean in itself, but it is unclean for anyone who thinks it unclean. Well, what then? Are the Sabbath and the dietary laws all just in the mind? Can we just close our eyes and enter a state of divacus and then just will them away? It reminds me of the movie The Matrix, when reality itself was just an illusion. So a person who was sufficiently enlightened and mentally focused could actually alter this so-called reality, right? And the success of the movie wasn't really so much that it was a new idea or unheard of, but because it's something we all kind of instinctively suspect to be really true in some sense. That reality that we know of is really more of a veneer. And true reality lies below the surface somewhere. After watching The Matrix, I don't know, it was 15 or 16 years ago, I suspect I was not the only one who couldn't help but like try out my mental powers just to see if I could bend the spoon or not. You know what I'm talking about? You did that, didn't you? So is Paul saying that that the Torah and its laws are like the Matrix? You know, people think that they're real, but they're actually just an illusion, and those who are mentally strong and enlightened enough can just will them away? But what if I told you that when Paul writes, one person believes he may eat anything, while the weak person only eats vegetables, he wasn't talking about the Jewish dietary laws at all. There's no law in the Torah that says that one must only eat vegetables. Did you notice that? Also, I just had some meat today. It was great. It was kosher. So notice how Paul calls the vegetarian, in this case, the weak one. This is a term that he uses elsewhere, notably in 1 Corinthians 8. 1 Corinthians 8 right here. I know you can't read that, but we'll zoom in a second. 1 Corinthians is a confusing epistle. It sounds, you ever notice this? It sounds schizophrenic. It sounds self-contradictory. And the reason it sounds that way is because Paul cites the arguments of people with an opposing view in order to refute those arguments. You ever, it's like an email where you've got the things that the person is saying, and then you're replying to that, and it's like in line like that. And if you didn't have the little greater than signs, you wouldn't know who's saying what, right? Let me just show you something, a really interesting pattern. How do we break this up? How do we get this to clarify who's doing what? I just highlighted the first person plural pronouns, okay? We, us, we, okay, right? Highlighted the first person plural pronouns. This is the way that the Corinthians speak. They say we, right? Paul responds to them by saying you and he, sometimes I, but they do. So now let's see. We highlight these. What sentences say we? These are the sentences that say we, all right? So let's take a look now that we've broken it up this way. Let's see if it makes sense. Watch this. The Corinthians say, "Now concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge." Paul comes and responds, "This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know it as he ought to know, but if anyone loves God, he is known by God." So the Corinthians continue their note. "Therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence and that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist." He responds, "However, not all possess this knowledge. But some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. You see how he's responding to their arguments, and he's not going back and forth on in his own, like, I'm not sure if I believe this or this. He's reacting to their letter. He's quoting their letter. They continue, food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. And now he comes in really hard with this one. But take care that this right of yours does not see how he switches it to yours, this right of yours? They say, we're not any better or any worse off or better off. And he says, take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. You see how neatly and cleanly that breaks up? And suddenly his argument is perfectly coherent and consistent. I just wish it was like that in our Bibles. So, now it should be obvious to us what a weak person is. In Romans 14, Paul talks about the weak and the strong. A weak person is not a person who wants to keep the Torah. As it says here, some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. So a weak person, in Paul's terminology, is someone who is sensitive with regard to idolatry. What is a strong person then? A strong person is a person with no former association with idols, and therefore their conscience is not easily harmed by them. So we see that the Corinthians were arguing for a matrix-like position. Meat offered to idols is only bad if we think it's bad. Paul refutes their argument and says, no, it's bad because it hurts other people in that case. So why in Romans does the weak person only eat vegetables? Why is it that they only eat vegetables? Because vegetables are safer than meat in terms of idols, because you don't offer vegetables as sacrifices to the gods. Okay, so there's a context here for the person who eats anything. One person thinks he can eat anything. Well, when we say anything, we don't mean anything. We're not talking about rubber tires or poison ivy or stolen candy or human flesh or BLTs. When we say you can eat anything, a person believes he can eat anything, he believes that the strong person believes that he feels he can eat any otherwise permitted food regardless of some association with idolatry. That's what we mean by anything. The weak person is careful to avoid certain items that are deemed to be contaminated by idolatry. So according to Paul, there's nothing wrong with being weak. It's not a flaw in a person for being weak. There's nothing wrong with their halakhic argument. In fact, that's actually his point in Romans 14. If being weak was wrong, then Paul wouldn't say, let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains. Right? Mark Nanos is a really well-known commentator on the book of Romans, and he points this out. If Paul meant to be disparaging by his term weak, he's all those weak people. If he was being disparaging by using that term, then he would be doing what he just told us not to do. And somehow in every commentary, whenever it tries to figure out who these weak people are, it immediately despises them. Every commentary on Romans does exactly what Paul says, don't do. And that's what Mark Nanos calls Luther's trap. Because Luther apparently did that as well. The point of Romans 14 is that the weak people and the strong people are on the same halakhic footing. They're on equal halakhic footing. Both opinions stand on firm ground. And that's why one camp should not be judgmental to the other. So let's continue on with Paul's discussion here about in Romans 14. He's talking about days. He says, one person esteems one day is better than another, while another person esteems all days alike. One should be fully convinced in his own mind. The one who observes a day observes it in honor of the Lord. Have you ever heard this verse being quoted in context of Shabbat and keeping the Sabbath? Have you ever heard people say that? And they might say, yeah, you know, I make sure to take a day off of work. I make sure, you know, every Tuesday I don't go in to work. I pray and stuff. So many readers assume that this passage is talking about the weekly Sabbath, right? To which day is the Sabbath? You know, some people think, well, one day is better than another. You know, back in the Old Testament, you had to do it on Saturday. But now, you know, just take a day off. It doesn't matter which one it is, as long as you do it in honor of God. But, of course, we just figured out what the context of this chapter is, right? It's all about, it's about idolatry. And that doesn't fit the context of this at all. And, of course, it's difficult because we've got a skewed translation. A few things you have to know about this. This Greek word is translated esteems.
Doesn't mean
esteems. Because when we say esteem, we think it's some kind of positive thing. Oh, I esteem that person. That means I think highly of them, right? Well, the Greek word here doesn't mean esteem. It means judge. If I say I'm judging that person, that's not positive at all, right? And it isn't necessarily negative either. It's just making a judgment. All right? So one day, one person judges one day.
But the phrase as better than doesn't actually exist in the Greek either.
It's just a preposition that means in contrast with. So that this is really changing the way that we're
interpreting that.
And then we have this term observes, the one who observes the day. But that's not the word that we use when we're talking about observing Shabbat, observing holidays. I don't know why they chose that word observes at all, because the word just means to be mindful of or to be concerned about something. We don't say we're mindful of Shabbat or concerned about Shabbat. Right? So the one who is mindful of the day is mindful of it. Right? And then actually that word for honor, if we want to be technical, is not in there either. It's just the case of the verb, or the case of the noun in that case, that just means two or four. Right? So it's two or four the Lord. You can see that there's a lot of translation issues here. And I'm not stretching. I'm not nitpicking here. Of course, if you already think you know what this passage means, it makes sense that you're going to translate it in that way. All right, so let's take a look at what it would be in a more objective translation. One person judges one day in contrast with another, while another judges all days alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. The one who is mindful or concerned about the day is mindful of it for the Lord. That's what Paul is saying. Now, if we know that the context of this passage is idolatry, because we were just talking about food offered to idols, then this suggests that the days that are in question here, that we might be mindful of or concerned about, are days and times that are of significance to idolaters. And Jewish law actually discusses business activities that are prohibited on or near Roman holidays out of concern that idolaters might attribute success to their deities. You engage in business a couple of days before this Roman holiday, and the Gentile who got a great deal will be like, oh wow, this is, you know, praise be to so and so, because he just granted me success. And so in the Talmud they say, you know, avoid this time and this time and this time. Even though those are not significant days on the Jewish calendar, they're only significant on the Roman calendar. Right? So just as with food, a weak person is one who is concerned and sensitive about the pagan associations with calendar observances. They modify their behavior so as to avoid the appearance of observing the day. Now, the strong person argues that one should not be concerned about the idolatrous significance of the day, since obsessing over the day of some other religion implicitly acknowledges that it has some true meaning. You see both opinions? So the same thing applies with food and with days. You know, the weak person says, oh, I'm not so sure if I should eat this. Is there something about idolatry with this food? And the strong person goes, idol schmeidel. None of that's real anyway. You're the one you're making the big deal about this God as if it's something. I don't, you know, or the person with the days. The weak person says, oh, I'm going to make sure not to do anything, you know, I better not go and do business here or do this or eat that on this holiday because it's a pagan holiday. And the strong person says, why do I need to look at the pagan calendar to figure out how to live my life? I don't care what day it is. Right? Both of them have a good point. Here's a practical
question.
October 31st, right? So practical application of this. So any other day of the year, somebody comes knocking on your door and asks for something to eat. What do you do? You open up the door. Oh, you're hungry. You want something to eat? Oh, here you go. And then you give them something to eat. You would do that because you're a generous person. Now, suddenly it's October 31st, and you're the stingiest person ever because you shut the door, you turn off the lights, pretend you're not home, right? Only because it's October 31st. So somehow that day has significance for you. The strong person says, what are you doing? You're giving power to that day by changing your behavior from what you would normally do. The weak person says, hey, I don't want to support someone else in practicing something that I don't think is right. I don't think it's biblical. I don't want them to have a good experience with that practice, right? Both of them have their positions. And both of them have a case that could be made. All right, so this is that's exactly the issue. So you have to know that Paul places both of these perspectives on equal footing. He wrote this letter not to say that one is right and that the other is wrong. That's not his point. Both positions have strong arguments. And both are actually, if you think about it, are righteous efforts to conform to the will of God. That's what they're both trying to do. They're both trying to do what is right in the eyes of God. There's this famous scene in Fiddler on the Roof where there's a dispute and Tevye says to the one, he's right. And then he says to the other, he's right. And someone objects, he's right and he's right. They can't both be right. And Tevye says, you're also right. Now, the idea of both being right bothers us with a Western mindset. But from a Jewish perspective, it's not only possible, it's common. And that's because a Jewish worldview understands the near impossibility of humans to know things empirically at all. So instead of valuing conclusions, Jewish philosophy places more emphasis on the process of deduction itself. So a valid argument produces a valid answer. An invalid argument cannot provide a valid answer, even if it's the so-called right answer. because it's the argument that matters. And since there can be more than one valid argument, there can be more than one valid answer. And this is especially true in the case, in the realm of halacha, where it's understood that there is not empirical right or wrong in halacha. Halacha is not discovered like mathematics or like geography is discovered, right? It's decided, it's established. The purpose of Jewish courts is to establish law based on consistent principles and arising from the Torah. So to understand this, imagine the city council was debating whether or not to place a stop sign at a certain location. One side says the stop sign will increase the safety of pedestrians. The other side says it will impede traffic too much. So the two opponents are try to show flaws and inconsistencies in each other's arguments at the city council meeting. And who's right? Who is right? Well, there is no empirical answer to that question about whether or not a stop sign should be at that exact location. Once they vote to put in the stop sign, it doesn't really matter what side you're on anyway. The sign is there. The process of putting it there was a valid process, so you better stop. What about something like ritual purity, though? You know, academics argue back and forth as to whether the ancient Israelites considered this matter of ritual purity to be one of substantive reality or legal formalism. I know those are technical sounding terms, right? But they kind of make sense if you think about it. What is it that makes a thing unclean? Is it unclean in some true empirical sense, whether that's a physical sense or a spiritual sense? It is ontologically unclean, right? Or is it unclean in a legal, judicial sense? In other words, is it the legal decision itself that makes it unclean? As long as it's a valid legal decision arising from the Torah. Well, whatever you think about the ancient Israelites, by the time of the Mishnah, Judaism had completely adopted this idea of legal formalism. And a good case for that can be made from the Torah itself. I mean, Leviticus 10:10 indicates that the Kohanim are to distinguish between the holy and the common and between the unclean and the clean. All right? That's part of their job, is to make those separations. Then in Leviticus 13, a person who has tzara'at, the biblical skin disease, is not actually clean or unclean until he is declared to be so by the Kohen. Indicating that it's the words of the Kohen that make him unclean. You know, that the interesting thing, so the sages comment on that, and they say, you know, the reason people get this tzara'at, this biblical skin disease, is because of improper speech, right? Have you heard that? People speak evil speech, and then they get this skin disease. So it's sort of a measure for measure that it's the speech of the priest that makes them clean or unclean. All right. So likewise, what does Deuteronomy say? And you shall come to the Levitical priests and the judge who is in the office in those days, and you shall consult them, and they shall declare to you the decision, and you shall do according to what they declare to you from the place that the Lord will choose, and you shall be careful to do all that they direct you. All right? It doesn't say if you agree with their ruling, or even if their conclusion is correct. I mean, the types of decisions that they're making in this context are automatically right as long as the judicial process described in Deuteronomy 17 is right. If the process is valid, the decision is valid. Now, I'm not saying that anything goes and that rabbis can declare whatever they want or even to go against the Torah, God forbid. It's just like in America. Judges have to follow a proper legal procedure. If a law in America or a ruling is unconstitutional or it's unjust, then it should be questioned and it should be resisted and it should be overturned. But all of that happens within the legal parameters set forth in our country's founding documents. You don't think the stop sign should be there. You think the stop sign is unconstitutional. You still stop, but then you go to the city council meeting and you say, this is a problem, and you make your case, right?
So, back to ritual purity. An idolater once came to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is a really important person to know about. He was the leading rabbi in the days of the apostles, all right? So this idolater came to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and says, you know, the things you Jews do, they're like witchcraft. So he brought up, in particular, the seemingly bizarre process of cleansing by the red heifer. Right? Think about this process of cleansing through the red heifer. You know, you take just a few drops of, you burn this thing into ashes, you mix it with a ton of water, and then you take like 3 drops of this and sprinkle it on a guy, and that's supposed to supposedly make him clean. 3 drops of water. So the idolater says, to me, that sounds like witchcraft. I don't know. Rabbi Yochanan tries to explain it. He tries to kind of get on the idolater's level and explain it to him. He says, you guys do exorcisms? The idolater says, yeah, we do exorcisms. Well, how do you go about doing that? And he says, well, we grind up some of these roots, herbs, and things like that, and then we set it on fire, and it makes a smoke, and the smoke comes up, and then that drives away the demon. So Rabbi Yochanan says, you know, that's kind of basically what we're doing here. It's like the uncleanness is like a demon that gets exorcised. So that the idolater went, oh, all right, okay. He kind of accepted that. But Rabbi Yochanan's disciples went, hey, wait a second. I mean, that was an okay answer for him, but we're not buying that. We're not buying that at all. Rabbi Yochanan said, okay, all right, listen. A corpse is not what makes a person unclean. And water sprinkled on somebody is not what makes a person clean. It's Hashem. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed is He. He says, I lay down a statute, I make a rule, and you're not allowed to transgress it. In other words, Rabbi Yochanan's view is that ritual purity is not intrinsic. It's not, a corpse isn't impure in and of itself. It's a Torah-defined legal status. It's like crossing state lines or something like that. Nothing happened to you when you did that. But suddenly now you're in a different legal setting. Why? Because in a book somewhere it says this is where Minnesota ends and this is where Wisconsin begins, right? Nothing actually changed about you when you stepped across the bridge, right? And that's what ritual purity is. You could take a microscope and put it on a ritually impure person. You're not going to find anything. You could X-ray them. You're not going to find anything, right? It's because it's a legal status. So in the world of Judaism, there are aspects of Jewish law. There are aspects of halacha that are universal. Every Jewish community you go to, you know, they're going to have some things in common. But on a lot of the finer details, the system that you follow
will depend on the community that you identify with. So every community might have a different valid process that leads them to their valid conclusions. But the conclusion that you arrive at will depend on the process, which depends on the community, right? So often, have you ever encountered this when you're trying to, if you're researching, how do we do this? How do we keep this commandment? And you look at maybe some ask, or you look at some sites online, or you read a book, and then the answer you get is, ask your rabbi. Yeah, that's why. Because it depends on your particular community's process. Well, you might think, I don't know, that doesn't make sense to me. I think that purity is a corpse is actually impure. It's not a legal thing, it's something about a corpse that is impure. Well, Paul would disagree with you, right? Because this is exactly what Paul meant when he said, nothing is unclean in itself, but it is unclean for anyone who thinks it unclean. So, in other words, the legal process is what determines the application of Torah in any given instance. The answer will depend on whom you ask. So Paul's point is not that the mitzvot are all in the mind. He's not saying that ritual purity is imaginary. Rather, he's helping us to learn how to navigate in situations where there might be more than one valid answer. There might be more than one valid legal opinion. So instead of insisting that our view is empirically right, it's the right view, and the other person is wrong, we are, according to Paul, or the point of Romans 14, if we're understanding what he's trying to tell us, we are to accept that sometimes you both can be right. And the person who is wrong is the person who despises his fellow and who insists that he has a monopoly on the Torah, a pipeline to God. So Paul's message, it's really key for us this time of year with holidays and red cups and, you know, family gatherings and things. You know, let's commit ourselves to whatever convictions we are, to hold those convictions, decide on something, ensure that our process, our reasoning is valid, and it's based on something substantive, something solid, right? But then let's, no matter how firmly and dearly we hold that opinion and how high of a standard we set up for ourselves in that opinion, make sure that we equally show love to one another and hold the standard to ourselves of Romans 14. Grant other people the benefit of the doubt, at all times. Can we do that? Yep. All right, let's pray.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your souls.